Welcome to the archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee, and thanks for tuning into Conversation for Exploration. I believe that our minds, consciousness, is the first and the last frontier. Have you ever wondered what secrets are locked away in parts of your mind and soul that require special access? And how can we make use of the mind-body connection? How can we make it work for us? And just what is our subconscious mind, and how does it work? And I've often wondered if intuition is fueled by what the unconscious mind knows and is telling the conscious mind, which then gets the message, but calls it intuition because we just don't see the connection between the subconscious and the conscious mind. Dr. Brian Weiss has been researching and writing about his adventures in hypnotic regression and what access to the subconscious mind can reveal. For some time now, he's the founding chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Florida's Mount Sinai Medical Center. He's a former professor of psychiatry at the University of Miami School of Medicine, and he's written 3 books, Many Lives, Many Masters, Through Time into Healing, and his latest, Only Love is Real. He joins us from Miami, home of our affiliate, WFTL. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Loralee.
Brian, first I have to ask you, because so much is being said about hypnotic regression and how it is abused by some therapists and can result in false memory syndrome, leading to erroneous and tragic accusations of child abuse or sexual abuse and such. We know that clinical experiments on children and adults alike demonstrate that if you're told an event happened to you often enough or under the right circumstances, you can incorporate it into your memory and believe it really happened to you when in fact it did not, i.e. that you then have a false memory. And on the other hand, the unconscious mind has been demonstrated to be a repository of the small details and events and forgotten conscious memories, and hypnosis has been found to be an effective means of accessing those details. So I'm just wondering whether a memory is there to be uncovered or put there. And I'm sure that there are cases of both, because it's never one or the other. It's rarely that simple. I wanted to know what you think about it. I think one thing we can agree upon, and that is certainly that consciousness is much more interesting and malleable and expansive than we generally acknowledge. I know the near-death experience of some people where they can accurately report back details that they saw around them when out of the body, or the person who remembers what is said by doctors in the operating room as they were unconscious, or in your work, consciousness taking us back to past lives. Well, it all demonstrates that consciousness cannot be contained or objectified as easily as we sometimes like to think. So I'd like your comments on false memory syndrome. And
sure.
Then I want to spend the rest of the hour asking you what you find most fascinating about your work.
Sure. Well, false memory syndrome, you have to remember, is not a black and white thing. And many people just lump it like that and leave it sitting there, which is wrong and very unscientific.
That's why I was saying it's neither one nor the other.
Right. It's why it's not used in a court of law. That's why hypnosis is not used, because sometimes small details can change.
Mm-hmm.
But when I go back and do regressions to childhood, to infancy, to in utero experiences, which are very commonly accessed, and to what seem to be past lifetimes, I'm not instructing the person to come up with anything. I'm just saying, go back there. I don't give them any suggestions. What they come up with is entirely their own. And sometimes the details are incredibly accurate. For example, they might speak a foreign language that they've never learned. This can't be suggested by the therapist.
Uh-huh.
This is called xenoglossy. And I've had this occur occasionally. Many times it happens in children, too, spontaneously. Or people will go back and, for example, read a concentration camp number off their arm in a past life memory, and actually find the person whose number that was, or find their graves, because they've come up with enough information in a hypnotic state. Now, these are not suggestions. You can't suggest an entire language and historical details that the person had no familiarity with. So when you sit back and talk about false memory syndrome, you have to remember that that refers only to courts of law and why it's not used, because there you have to be 100% accurate. If I'm doing this for therapy and the person is 95% accurate, that's pretty good, because oftentimes it's like a dream. There may be a little bit of distortion in there, some metaphor, some symbol, and some very accurate memory. And frequently they get all mixed together. It's the job of the therapist to figure out what is what, to interpret that, and that's how therapy is done.
Okay, so, two questions. Mm-hmm. If hypnotherapy is not accepted into court of law as proof, and I agree it shouldn't be, it can just lead us into interesting ways and questions, then how is it that some people who were falsely accused, it's now been decided, and were in the meantime put away into jail for child abuse or sexual abuse or whatever, how did they end up in jail after a trial if it was just a memory that was planted in by a therapist who was abusing the technique?
Oh, because trials have nothing to do with facts. They're just
We've learned that recently, haven't we, with some celebrated trials. Okay, enough said on that. And the other question then is, I understand that human minds like to make stories. We tell ourselves stories. We see the world in stories in order to string events together. And so are you cautious about that we might be stringing things together because that's just the way our mind likes to work?
Sure. Absolutely. But you have to remember, perhaps what's really helped me is my training as a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to remember that when a trained therapist, and most of the bad work that's done with false memory syndrome has not been done by good therapists, usually not by therapists. A hypnotist, for example, may have very good training or may not. You can learn hypnosis in 4 weekends. But to really be well-trained in therapy can take many years. You have to know what you're doing. So when a good therapist goes back and uses hypnosis or other techniques for accessing the unconscious mind, there's not a suggestion being made. I may tell someone, for example, to go back to the time from which your symptoms first arise. That may be my only comment.
And they will choose the time to go back to.
And all of the details and how it happened. And oftentimes you see great clinical change when this happens, which I don't think would happen from imagination. For example, I was treating the wife of a physician here in Miami, and she had a lifelong fear of the dark. She made her family stay around. Lights had to be on whenever it was dark. And in regression work, we found out that in a recent past lifetime, she had drowned as a teenager at night, and her fear of the dark came from that memory, and the fear began to dissipate, to disappear after she had this memory. And unbeknownst to me, she also had a lifelong fear of water, and that began to clear up too. That's a quick example, and usually does not happen so quickly as that, of how symptoms can resolve from this type of work, and how very little suggestion is done by a good therapist, that you really don't have to suggest.
When we bring up a memory from the subconscious that might be causing those side effects like fear of water, fear of drowning, fear of the dark,
mm-hmm.
And you bring it to light, what is it about bringing a subconscious memory to the conscious mind that then alleviates the problem? Why is it just that you now recognize in your conscious mind, oh, I've got this past life experience or this experience over here I'd forgotten about? Why is that process enough to start dissolving the symptoms?
I don't know that anybody really knows how the process works. It's been called catharsis or abreaction by therapists for many years. That is, remembering traumatic events or other events with emotion, cathartic experiences. And it works. It works in Freudian psychotherapy and psychoanalysis when you go back and remember childhood memories with emotion and it clears up. I think it has, in part at least, to do with understanding. When you can understand events and put them into perspective, mm-hmm. in the perspective of the adult mind, that has a clearing effect. You don't react as you did when you were a child or in a past life.
It doesn't have that hold over you anymore.
Exactly. It's partly the understanding, but there's some part of that process that we don't really know why it works or how it works. It's this catharsis, remembering with emotion, has a clearing effect on the symptoms that you may have carried forward to the present time.
And you began as a psychiatrist, I understand. When did you start to incorporate hypnotic regression into your therapy? What inspired you to do that? Because you found great value in that, obviously.
Yes, well, I had been trained at Yale Medical School, where I was also did my residency training, and I was a professor at Pittsburgh and the University of Miami, too. I had learned hypnosis as I was an intern at Bellevue Medical Center in New York City. My supervisor, and who went around the wards with me on the psychiatry part of that rotation, would hypnotize patients for pain relief and insomnia, things like that. And I learned how to do it very well that year. And I kept doing it now and then in my practice over the years. But what happened that turned my whole practice around was a patient that I had in the early 1980s when I was chairman of the psychiatry department at Mount Sinai. She was a laboratory technician in the hospital, a Catholic woman from New England in her late 20s, with profound fears, anxiety attacks, and depression, recurring nightmares. These were her symptoms. I wanted to use hypnosis because doing traditional therapy was not really going anywhere. She couldn't take any medicine because she had a lifelong fear of gagging. Finally, she allowed me to do the hypnosis after she got rid of her fear of giving up control. This never happens in hypnosis. And we went back, and I found pretty severe traumas from her childhood, but her symptoms did not resolve. So thinking that she must have been traumatized even earlier in her childhood, when she came in the next week, I told her, go back to the times where your symptoms first began, thinking she'd go back to early childhood. But her subconscious mind, taking that literally, which is what the subconscious does, went back about 4,000 years. And she's describing now, with emotion and in detail, a past life experience, although I didn't believe in this at all at the time, in the Near East about 4,000 years ago, in a different body, going through that lifetime, drowning in a flood or tidal wave at the end of that life, and then floating above her body, finding a beautiful light that refreshed her. And this is very reminiscent of the near-death experience work of Raymond Moody and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and others. And then she went into two other lifetimes that first time. Hmm. When she came out of it, her lifelong fear of gagging over the course of the next week or two began to resolve and was 80% better after just a few weeks. And that surprised me because I knew that imagination or fantasy doesn't cure such chronic symptoms. So I kept doing this, and that was 1,400 patients ago and about 15 years ago. So it's been a long journey for me since that time. That was the beginning, Lorelei.
And we'll hear more of the adventures into past lives, hypnotic regression, and the subconscious and conscious mind with Brian Weiss, author of Many Lives, Many Masters, Through Time into Healing. I'm Lorelei. Lorelei here on The Lorelei Show. We're talking with Brian Weiss, and he's an expert in hypnotic regression and what it can teach us about the conscious mind, the subconscious mind, our souls, and our destiny. Brian, when Valentine's Day came up, we were talking about love affairs and how people got together. And I think one of the most romantic stories going is the story of two people that keep finding each other through various lifetimes. Have you come up with stories like that in your work?
Oh, yes. That last book, Only Love is Real, is a story about soulmates reunited, about two patients of mine who found each other. And I've been finding that over the years, that we seem to come around in life after life with many of the same people. The relationships change. The souls are the same. For example, a grandmother might be a sister or a brother, something like that. But we have this little pod or core group that we come around with. There may be one, like a twin flame or a twin soul, that's so close it's the other half of you. But there are others, a dozen or so, perhaps some more than that, who are so close that it's hard to tell the difference. And it's very romantic when soulmates find each other. That's, to me, cases of love at first sight and instant recognition and that kind of familiarity of knowing a new person at depths far beyond what you could consciously know them.
Could you define twin flame, twin soul, soulmate?
Well, to me, these are souls with whom you've been together before. You have an energy or a vibration that's so similar, they're almost another part of you.
Cut of the same cloth, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's these people that we recognize. I think when we run into them, it may be a look in the eyes, a touch of the hand, the first kiss, but there's something extra special. And when you meet a soulmate, the energy can be very high. It's not always romantic. Mm-hmm. It may be, as I said, a grandparent and grandchild, but there are people that are there because we're working through our lives together in physical form, in these bodies. We learn through relationships. Here's where we experience pain. We can do a great amount of learning here. We learn through our soulmate relationships especially. Also, I would add that I think a meeting of a soulmate is destiny. We're going to meet soulmates. That's part of the plan. But what we do after the meeting falls into the realm of free will. We may leave because we have a bias. We may not get together. We may not work together. We always have that free will, but we will meet them. You don't have to push the river.
And how about yours in your life?
Well, I think there certainly I haven't found my wife in a past life, but I know that we've been together many times. She says the same thing. Mm-hmm. I found my son in an ancient time, and my daughter I haven't found, but she's so close to me that this is a very close core group. And my youngest brother, I've always felt a connection from the time he was born. A very strong connection.
You know what it implies? If two people decide while they're still souls, they decide, okay, in this lifetime we're going to meet, it means that there is a purpose to our life. It means that there's some sort of higher being, soul, consciousness, intelligence directing us. It means that whether it's working through intuition or the events of our life, that just we happen to be in the same city, or we happen to know mutual friends, or we happen to bump into each other in the street, whatever the circumstances are, it means that there's a rhyme and a reason and a direction and a map for our life. Isn't that comforting in a sense?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I completely agree with you. There really is a plan there, a destiny at work, and it's all for learning. That's what when I do this work, sometimes my patients, in these very, very deep states, access a kind of wisdom that's not there in their conscious waking states. And there's such a similarity in this wisdom from one to the next. It's extraordinary. And there's a whole, a philosophy of spirituality that's there, and it's very consistent.
And what does it say? Tell me some of the tenets of this philosophy.
Okay. Sure. Well, the most important part is that we don't die when our bodies do, that a part of us goes on. Consciousness exists outside of the body. It's non-local, as people are saying now. And that whatever you want to call this, soul or spirit or consciousness, doesn't matter. But that's our real self. This goes on and may come back to reincarnate if necessary, if we still have learning, if we haven't mastered all the lessons. The lessons we have to master are old ones. We know this. It's about becoming more loving, becoming more compassionate, more understanding, more tolerant, becoming nonviolent. And the more I thought about these things, the more it seemed that we really know these. We don't have to learn them. We just have to unlearn those traits that get in the way, such as selfishness and greed and violence and hatred and bigotry and so on and so on. We know what these are. We just don't do it. And we have to remember. We have to awaken, because so many of us are like sleepwalking through these lives. When you see the bigger picture and you know that this is really not the only time that we're here, and indeed this is not the only place that our souls go on, our spirits go on, that puts things into perspective, and it really changes our values.
And it makes this life take on a whole new meaning. Welcome back with Brian Weiss. In fact, I'd like to take your phone calls. I'm Laura Lee. Hi, we are with Brian Weiss. He is a past life expert. He's been looking at many, many patients and effecting a healing by asking them through hypnotic regression to look at some of their earliest occurrences of certain symptoms. It's a fascinating study. He's the author of a number of books, Many Lives, Many Masters, Through Time into Healing, and Only Love is Real. Hannibal is in Seymour, Tennessee, listening to WGY out of Albany. Hi, Hannibal. Thanks for finding us.
Hi. My question for your guest is, why doesn't our mind know about reincarnation instantly? I mean, why don't we just let everything out? What's the point of the subconscious or anything?
Oh, you mean why are we divided into the ego, the conscious mind, the waking mind, the subconscious, the soul? Why do all these various divisions?
Yeah, and also, why don't we just know that we keep coming back and stuff?
Depends on what part of ourselves we're asking, I guess. What do you say, Brian?
Well, I think the reason that we don't remember past lives, although many more people are, many children are remembering spontaneously, many more adults are too, now that it's not such a stigma to talk about it. I think the reason that most people don't remember, though, is because we come here to learn. And if we knew that we were going to be punished for being violent when we died, that wouldn't really be learning. We come here to see if the learning is really in our nature. Is it really in our heart? Are we nonviolent? Because that's wrong. That's in our heart and we know it. So I think that's why we don't remember. It would be too much of a burden to carry around and it would not be true learning. This is like the field test, like school. And that's why we don't remember, it seems.
Also, I think our minds and consciousness are like radio receivers and transmitters. And if we were able to access everything that went on, everything that it was access, I think the unconscious or the superconscious is accessing it. But I think that we have to filter it down to focus on this classroom, this journey, this sojourn on Earth. Otherwise, it could get real confusing.
Right. It can be really overloading, too. You run into someone you met in the 15th century and you have a grudge against them, and that's not the right thing to do. It would be too much. I think that all knowledge is there, and the psychoanalyst Carl Jung called this the collective unconscious. The great American psychic Edgar Cayce called it the Akashic Records. We can tap into all of these things. We really do know everything, but we have to filter. We have to focus on this classroom. I agree with you.
And it's like we're following one thread in a great large tapestry.
Right.
To focus on this life. And that's a test of character.
Mm-hmm.
If we knew all the answers, it wouldn't be a test, would it?
Right, exactly.
No point going to school.
Right.
So, Sue is in Carson City, Nevada, listening to KOH at Reno. Hi, Sue.
Hi, and hi, Dr. Weiss. It's a privilege to talk to you.
Thank you, Sue.
I've read three of your books, Many Lives, Many Masters, Through Time into Healing, and Only Love is Real. My husband died suddenly of a heart attack 3.5 years ago.
Oh, dear.
And it brought all of these things into play for me, because I had been raised a Catholic and rejected that and became an atheist, and that's where I was when he died. And so it was like I didn't have any kind of a spiritual base, and so I started looking at things again, and I looked at it from a very scientific, logical approach. And that's what appealed to me about your books. When you talked about your practice and everything, it was so obvious that these were very real experiences that it gave me something to go on and continue looking along these lines. And I'd like to ask you if you can make a referral to anybody in the West Coast area to go see about a past life regression.
I have a list of therapists that practice around the country. I can give out my office number, right, Laurie? And people can contact the office to get a list of therapists?
Sure.
Okay, it's 305-661-6610 during the week. That's the office, 305-661-6610. And the office has a list of therapists in different cities.
And 305-661-6610. Thanks, Sue, and good luck to you. When people start to have a spontaneous memory of a past life? In what form does it come? Your dreams, a daydream, a series of mind pictures maybe that are reoccurring? How does it happen?
It can be all of those, Laura Lee. Sometimes it's a deja vu. I had a nurse as a patient, an intensive care unit nurse, who, traveling in Paris for the first time in this life, knew her way around where the old church used to be that was no longer there. We found that she had lived there in a recent past life. So sometimes it's deja vu. Sometimes it comes in dreams. And when you dream of yourself in an ancient time and a different body, that may not be a Freudian distortion. It may be a memory fragment emerging whole in the dream. It can happen in just observing your own talents and abilities. Could a young Mozart just start writing symphonies at the age of 4 or 5, or did he bring this talent over from a past life?
So that's where we get child prodigies.
Maybe. Maybe that's another clue to that. Sometimes being, as I said, in the geographical area, that kind of deja vu can stimulate it. I've had several cases of people traveling in different countries who could suddenly speak the language, and they couldn't do that in their usual conscious state, just by being in the same area again.
So you might have some memory trigger.
Right. Sometimes it's in the body. And massage therapists or body workers tell me that they may be working on a part of the body, the ankle, the arm, the shoulder, and just stimulating that or pressing on that, and a past life memory spontaneously emerges.
Oh, here's my best story of that. I was in the British Museum. I was in college taking overseas study programs for art history. So I'm in the British Museum, and I'm walking out the door at the end of a long day, cruising around looking at everything, and all of a sudden I had this magnetic pull over to this case. And I wasn't interested in going there, but I just got drawn there. And so I go over to the case, and there was this Celtic scrolly ironwork stuff. And intellectually, I'm not attracted to it, but I looked at this stuff. Tears came to my eyes. I was just mesmerized, and I went into an altered state. And this lasted for several minutes, and then I just said, wow, what was that? And I thought, okay, past life, that's the only explanation I can give. And I went back to my art history professor, and I told him about this experience, and he says, oh, my dear, you would make a very good art historian. You really emote with the art, don't you? I said, no, I don't think so. I think it was something else, but anyway.
That's how it works. That's a very good example of getting stimulated by the actual object or geographical location. And I've had this happen so many times in my practice, patients telling me, people telling me. There are many non-hypnotic ways that past life memories emerge.
Mm. I think also I had one in a Greek temple where it was bright sunlight, and I'm walking down the columns, and when you walk through these columns, it has kind of a strobe effect, light, dark, light, dark, light, dark, shadow, sun, shadow, sun. And so I'm walking over to the entrance, and I'm going, this is putting me in an altered state. This is just, you know, anything can do that. This is how fire works, I think, the crackling, bright shadow fire of a fire, shadow
right.
light of a fire. And so I said to this other art history professor, I said, you know, these Greeks knew what they were doing, didn't they? They set this up so that just mere walking to the temple and going through the strobe effect, already you were in an altered state by the time you got there,
those
ready
Greeks
for those
knew.
Ceremonies.
Mm-hmm. They really knew. They built their temples in such a way. Raymond Moody is an expert on this, too, and we're going to Crete very soon together to teach a course there. They built the temples in such a way that it was light, dark, up, down, underground parts. They knew how to stimulate altered states.
Mm. That must be a fun program going to create. And I'm going to enjoy meeting you at the Body Soul Conference, too.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to coming to Seattle, and we're going to Boulder, too, as you mentioned, and many other places, the Boston
one, San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Dan is in Washington State, listening to KVI out of Seattle. Hi.
I would like to relay the phenomena, what's known as young cellular memory. That's not a theory. It actually does happen. Is that more or less
young cellular memory?
Carl Jung. He
Carl
was an associate
Jung, okay.
of Freud's.
Got it.
About past life memory. You're talking about memories of childhood once they surface.
Right.
Well, according to law, Vienna law, they had to take a record of the patients they had in therapy. And Jung started taking a lot of instances where people had recalled of being in another lifetime, of people that they knew and circumstances and situations that they had encountered, and what he had accomplished towards the end of his career was a book full of really odd experiences. What cellular memory is it's written in the cells of past generations. So it might be that the inequity of someone's past existence might be passed on to the second generation or so many generations down the line in order to be resolved.
You know, you bring up a really good issue, Dan, and what do you think about that? Because you hear about miasms. People who deal with homeopathics will talk about miasms, just little energy codes that are there in the water, could be in a cell. And you don't think of memory as having a location in the body. They're kind of disproving that memory is located anywhere. It might come into play with Rupert Sheldrake's morphogenetic field theory or something. But what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that memory is probably not all located within the physical body. Some of it is, because you can stimulate the brain, as Wilder Penfield and other researchers have done, and evoke even past life memories. But some memory must not be, because people remember, as you talked about earlier, from near-death experiences or events at a far distance from the body, like out-of-body experiences. So I think there's more to it. I know that many of the past life memories are not cellular or genetic, because so many people have died as children or died never having passed on any genetic material. So you have to look beyond that. Carl Jung wrote quite a bit about past lives, and he believed in it more than just the cellular. He explored all aspects. He was really a scholar, though, of Eastern concepts and philosophies and how that impacted in psychoanalytic theory. He probably had the most complete understanding of the interaction of past lives and present lives of the early psychoanalysts. So I've quoted him in some of my books. He was a brilliant researcher.
We'll come right back and talk more. I also want to hear, Brian, when we do come back, about your favorite, most stunning story of one of your patients and a session of hypnotherapy. What were some of the most stunning revelations that came through this process? We'll hear all about that when we come back. I'm Laura Lee. I'm Laura Lee. You're listening to The Laura Lee Show. George is in Honolulu, Hawaii, listening to KHVH for Brian Weiss. Hi, George. Thanks
Hello
for joining
there.
Us.
I have a question relating the astrological birth signs to past life regression.
Oh, interesting.
Is there any correlation? And I keep running into blocks over and over and over again, and I keep trying to remember this too will pass. But I hate to think that I'm going to keep drawing on the past forever into the future.
Well, it's not forever. Hopefully we learn and we graduate, like going through school, and we move on. About the astrology, I didn't really know anything about astrology. They don't teach that at Yale Medical School. And then I had been doing this work secretly, really privately, because I was chairman of a psychiatry department. There was a great risk for me in being public about doing past life therapy work in a very conservative hospital and medical center.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, took me 4 years to write Many Lives, Many Masters after I finished with Catherine because of that fear of my reputation and my career. It was really flourishing. But I eventually I wrote this book, and I did a foreword for a book by Jean Avery, who's an astrologer, and she wrote a book called Astrology and Your Past Lives. And then that was my going public, really, because that came out right after Many Lives, Many Masters. And in that book, even though I didn't know about astrology, I knew about past lives, and I learned quite a bit that Jean was writing about the placement of Saturn in the 12th house and what is in the 12th and the first houses being very connected to past lives. And she actually, we did a little bit of a project where she wouldn't know anything about my patients with whom I had done some regressions, but would only know their astrological data, their place of birth and their time of birth, and she could come up with some of the past lifetimes. So there's something to it. I don't know exactly why or how it works, but it's more than you would expect from chance.
Hmm. Interesting. And we are not fated then by our astrology charts, I don't think. I mean, it might give you a list of energies, there might be some connection, but I think free will comes in here. And
it has to, or else we wouldn't learn. But what the astrologers say is that the stars don't compel you, they impel. There's maybe a push. But it's not definitive. If it were, we could never learn.
And tell me one of the most fascinating stories that you have among all your many.
I was thinking about that after you mentioned that, Laurelie, and I still think that the first one, Catherine, the woman in many lives, many masters, is the most compelling and powerful for me.
Give us a quick rundown of that.
Well, she was the one who went back to Egypt or the Near East 4,000 years ago. Her fear of gagging began to disappear, her other symptoms. But I was very, very skeptical. As the chairman of the psychiatry department, I was very formally trained. I didn't believe in this, and I was still thinking, I don't know why she's getting better, but it must be imagination or fantasy. It can't actually be past lives. And then about the fourth or fifth time we were doing this, she floated above her body, found this beautiful light. She had died in the Middle Ages lifetime. And she told me there were two people there to see me, my father and my son. The room was dark. I remember it feeling icy cold. We were the only two people in the office. My secretary was just outside in the next office. And I knew she knew nothing about me. I don't even have diplomas hanging in my office. Because one theory of psychotherapy is you want the patient to project their feelings and ideas and thoughts about the therapist into the therapeutic arena. This is called the transference reaction. Then you analyze that. That's how I was trained. Mm-hmm. And she said, your father is here. His name is Avram. And that's how she pronounced it. She's a Catholic woman from New England. His name is Avram. He died from his heart. And your daughter is named after him. And then she went on and said, and your son is here. And he's very tiny and shining brightly. And his heart is important also because it's turned around backwards. And then she explained why he died and how that was important to push me back into psychiatry. This was all very shocking to me because it was so accurate. Mm. My father's Hebrew name was Avram, but nobody ever called him that. He was called Reds because of his hair color. There was no place to look this up, nobody to talk to, no obituary even. He had died 2 years before I was doing the therapy with Catherine in New Jersey, which is 1,200 miles distance from Miami, of a heart attack. She was right about that. And my daughter, Amy, born a few months after he died, was indeed named after him. And the most tragic event in my life to that time was the death of my first son at the age of 23 days of a very rare congenital heart defect where the blood vessels from the lungs to the heart were coming in the wrong side of the heart as if it were turned around backwards functionally. And she knew that. There was no place to look that up, nobody to talk to. And that was important to push me back into psychiatry because I was an intern in medicine when he died. I was thinking about going into internal medicine, but then in my grief and despair at the death of this little baby, I was reminded of the power of the mind, why I had been interested in psychiatry in the first place, and it was instrumental in pushing me back into psychiatry, and she knew that. I remember thinking at that moment, if she's right about these things, about my father and my son, could she be right also about past lives and reincarnation? And that was the transforming event for me. That's still being obsessive compulsive. I went to the medical library. I had to research it, read it out, find out more information. But that was the beginning for me.
You're like me. The intellect has to be satisfied about letting go of the intuition or the experience. I like
exactly.
it when they all come together. Well, hypnotherapy is quite a tool for healing, isn't it?
It's very powerful, and it's important for people to understand that it's not such a strange thing. We all get hypnotized every day when you're driving your car and you forget the last few blocks, but you haven't crashed. That's hypnosis. When you're absorbed in a good movie and you're not hearing the person eating popcorn next to you, because you're concentrating, that's hypnosis.
You turn on the television, hypnotized.
Hypnotized, reading a good book. It's just the focusing of the concentration. That's all it is. There's nothing mysterious about it.
Hmm. Mark is in Portland. Hi, Mark.
You know, I really think that we do need to know about what happened to us in former lives. And okay. I'll tell you why, because I was murdered in a former life by having my throat cut by a drunken soldier. And I only became aware of that as a result of seeing it enacted on television. Zorba the Greek, when the woman who had the affair with the Englishman was surrounded by the villagers and one of them cut her throat, I suddenly felt the same knife across my own throat, and I just almost threw up.
So it was a trigger experience for you. Thank you for that. I'm going to give the last minute to Brian. So these things can happen.
Oh, absolutely. And often you see symptoms resolving when you have these memories. For example, with the neck, someone who may have been hanged and has neck problems, when you remember it, it resolves. Asthma, and you've died in a fire or smoke, inhaling that and the searing heat, that often gets better, maybe not completely and not in all cases, as you remember. So the remembering is very important. Sometimes when your throat has been cut, there might be a neck symptom or a scar. Frequently you see that in babies. They have little birthmarks or scars at the site of mortal injuries from previous lives. So these are all clues.
Boy, how interesting. What are some other clues, and what tips do you have for us to pay attention to these, to make use of them, to
gain access? Well, the first thing
is
to become aware. You know, are you drawn to any particular culture, or do you have an affinity to a historical period? Because these might be clues. Look at your symptoms, that back pain that seems chronic, the neck pain, things that have been there since childhood. It's just becoming aware, awakening. And when you do that, then your life takes on an entirely different perspective, and you begin to lose your fears.
And it becomes a whole new adventure. Thank you, Brian. Looking forward to meeting you here in Seattle on April 11th and the 13th at the Body Soul Conference. That was Dr. Brian Weiss. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.